So we're continuing in our series on origin stories. And you heard Jose read the text today, Genesis 16 and 21, a compilation that I made, because it tells the same story. You know, the book of Genesis is such an interesting book of the Bible. It's sometimes hopping around, right? And part of that is because Genesis, like the other five books of the Torah, is also a sort of a compilation. A few different editors made their different suggestions, and so they tell stories differently. So the story that Jose read is the story of Hagar and Ishmael. And what we don't know about that story is if Genesis 15 is a separate story from Genesis 21, or if it's a continuation of the story. Nonetheless, I want to say a few things about this story before we begin our conversation with Amaka. We're continuing here in this series on origin stories, and as we look at the story of the founding family of our faith, Abraham, his wife, Sarah, their son, Isaac, who you all probably know, then there's this other level to it, the story within the story, as Pastor Maria alluded to. There's enslaved woman Hagar and her son with Abraham, Ishmael. They're less famous, less discussed. And Amaka is here with me to tell her origin story and help us better understand what is happening in this text and why we as a church need to be attentive to Hagar's story, to Ishmael's story. But before we turn fully over, let me just say these few quick points about this story to give you some context. As you know, Abram and Sarah get this promise from God. God will make them a great nation. Yet time is ticking and Abram and Sarah are both getting old. They don't have any offspring. So Sarah suggests the idea, maybe so that I can have a family, go and sleep with my slave woman, Hagar. Now, just right there, our guide this summer, Dr. Miguel de la Torre, says that in the telling of this story of Abram, the Bible casually mentions the fact that Hagar is an enslaved woman. The Bible offers no moral, cultural, or social judgment on her status. For the writer of Genesis, Miguel de la Torre says, slavery is so normalized and legitimized that there appears nothing wrong with this peculiar institution. And so it says nothing of Hagar and Ishmael's status. So we begin the story of our faith with this dark side. With a story of a God, it seems, who gives through taking, who blesses at the expense of others, and who doesn't seem bothered by Hagar's objectification, exploitation, and her ultimate banishment. We want to be a place where we're responsible readers of the text, so we must begin our theological reflection from this place. Who is this God? What is this story? Who is this family? Dr. Dolores Williams, a womanist ethicist and biblical scholar, says in her book, Sisters in the Wilderness, that for Hagar, this relationship symbolizes through a historic relationship between black women and white women in the United States, where enslaved black women had no control over their bodies and often found no solidarity from white women who could have been their allies, although still subject to the whims of a patriarchal system themselves. Williams interprets Hagar's act of choosing death in the wilderness as a possible hint of liberation. Hagar protests her condition, she protests her treatment, and honestly, both of those stories remind me, Lubav, of Toni Morrison's story, right? Of the novel Beloved, where Sethi, an enslaved black woman, protests her condition and protests the conditions that her kids will be born in by, and it was controversial then and still controversial now, by killing them because she would rather them die than be in bondage. Toni Morrison wrote that story about an actual enslaved woman who did this. And so for me, and I imagine for you, this brings up much, especially as we try to be a church that makes space for everyone. There's value in this story, but to get to the value, we must go through this haunting text. We must ask, what does it mean for the father and the mother of our faith, Amaka, to be deporters and exilers in chief? What does it mean for them to be exploiters and enslavers in Kyiv? Especially when we are reminded the heaviness of all of that this week as we stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters who are rounded up in Mississippi. What is mean for the story of the promise of our faith to begin with exclusion and death? What does it mean for Ishmael to be the son of Abraham but not worthy of the covenant? When I think of this, I'm reminded of James Baldwin, whose 95th birthday would have been this week, who said in this classic work, "I was a kind of a bastard of the West." And so if we're not careful, Ishmael can just be a kind of bastard of our faith. So the question before us is, what does this origin story mean for us? What does it tell us about ourselves? What does it tell us about God? What can we learn from those present in it but excluded from it? Perhaps Ishmael and Hagar can be our teachers this morning and our guides. So I invite you all in as me and Amaka try to provide insight into this text. I have here Amaka Anku, who, for those of you that don't know, Amaka has been a member of this church for almost as long as I've been here, so almost 5 years. Amaka came right in and said, "I want you to dedicate my kids." And I was like, "Okay, I haven't met you before, but it's cool." Yeah, that's like, and I was like, "Let me just get this right. You want me to dedicate your kids?" She's like, "Yeah, I want them to grow up in this church." And I said, "That's a beautiful thing." And so we did, and we've gotten to know each other very well. Amaka will tell you more of her story, but I'll just say briefly, Amaka is a brilliant woman. She went to Princeton and Harvard Law School, works in international affairs. She has a beautiful husband and two beautiful kids, Kesade and Sally, who I'm sure you all know and get to see often. So just to begin, Amaka, can you tell us a little bit about your origin story? Where are you from? How did you get here? What questions drove the early part of your life?
Sure. Okay. Hi, guys. Thank you for this opportunity, if I may call it that, this to share my story. I'm not sure yet if it's an opportunity or something else, but we'll find out. So I was born in New York to a Nigerian father and a Caribbean mother. My parents didn't have they didn't feel that they had a great sort of future in the U.S. They didn't have great jobs and so on and so forth. So they moved back pretty quickly after they had me. I was probably a few months old. So I grew up in Nigeria and grew up in a pretty small town for Nigeria, but I was surrounded by mostly people who speak the same language, Igbo, which is my dad's ethnic group. You know, obviously everybody in Nigeria, well, not everybody, most people in Nigeria are African and black. But, you know, I wasn't a stranger to diversity, even though I lived in a place where most people spoke my language, most people were Igbo. My mom was Caribbean, and she was a part of a group of what we called Niger wives. So there were basically non-Nigerians married to Nigerian men, and mostly Eastern European women. And so, you know, we went to a lot of events, and some of our best friends were biracial kids. And so, I mean, all of this, I could say a lot about my origin story, but I'm trying to give just enough to give you context for the discussion that we will have. So I also went to church, and church for me was a very coercive experience growing up. It was all about, like, you had to fit this model of what you were supposed to do, and if you didn't, you were a bad Christian, or you weren't a Christian, or you were a bad person. So, like, you know, we couldn't wear pants. You had to wear a skirt. You had to cover your hair. You know, you had to believe certain things. If you questioned it, then you were bad, right? So that was my experience growing up.
So It's not working. So you carry a lot of identities, and one of the things that we joke about, right? So you Amaka, you're born in New York, grew up in Nigeria. You have a U.S. passport, right? And I was born in Liberia. I've been here almost all 30 years of my life, and I don't have a U.S. passport. And so, you know, so we joke, who's the American, right? You know? Is it you or is it me? And, you know, and I say that to say, but for real, like, who's the American? And are you an American? Does your passport make you an American? And how do you think about that part of your identity?
Yeah, I don't know. So I would say that, I mean, it's something that I struggled with actually quite a bit when I first came to the U.S. Today, I would say that being American is definitely a part of my identity, right? I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm Black, I'm Nigerian, and being American is a part of it. But I struggled with it early on because when I first came to the U.S., so I was a teenager, I was 15 when I first came, and then I was 17 when I went to Princeton, and I realized very early on that race was always this elephant in the room. It was always this big thing that defined the minority experience, defined the experience of people like me, but the majority culture seemed to want to pretend didn't exist, right? And I struggled with it because, you know, again, for someone like me who I had grown up never thinking about the color of my skin, but in America, I felt like people wanted to put me in a Black box, right? That was what they saw when they saw me. And it wasn't a good box to be in, is what I quickly learned. It was the box of all the bad things you could think of, you know, lazy people, poor people, violence, crime, failure, right? And, you know, and sometimes it was an explicit description that you saw on TV, on the 10 p.m. news or whatever. Before now, I watch CNN, but all those regular news stations where there was always some Black person being searched for something, right? And there was a picture, you know, and things like that. And so other things, it wasn't as explicit. It was but it was still as stark, right? Like this almost near synonymity of poor with Black, right? In some neighborhoods.
You didn't want to be Black, really.
So I didn't exactly. So. I thought, you know, this is not a box I want to be in. And I wasn't sure. So, and a lot of this was happening. So when I got to Princeton, I wasn't sure where I fit in, right? I knew that I didn't fit in with the Black story, but I obviously didn't fit in with the white story either. And I always, you know, I tell this story. I remember one of my sort of very early racial experiences at Princeton was when I walked into this cafeteria. This happened pretty often, but it was usually a Black table. And I felt like if I wasn't at a Black table, then the Black people were like, why are you not at a Black table? Are you trying to be white? And if I was sitting somewhere else, and white people would be like, why are you not at the Black table? You know, isn't that where you fit in? Anyway, so I tried sitting at the Black table. I realized that I didn't have the experience of Black Americans because I didn't understand the culture references. So my solution, all of this is, my solution was to reach back to my roots, right? Like, I couldn't belong. I didn't feel like there was no space or mechanism for me to figure out where I belonged in this very racialized Black and white, you know, system that, at least as I was perceiving it. And so my solution was to just, you know, go back to being, I'm Nigerian, right? And I felt like I needed to root myself somewhere, to belong somewhere in order to actually be successful in my Princeton experience. So I started an African students group. You know, that basically ended up being like the comfortable space I created for myself was being Nigerian. Later on, I mean, and I, you know, it was a tense relationship with, you know, we had a Black students union and they felt like I was splitting up the Black voice. I didn't understand sort of where that you know, sort of antagonism was coming from, because I thought, well, I can be black and be other things, right? Like, what is this single story? I feel like there was always a single story. So I came to understand it later, because I, you know, what I came to understand later was that the black students on campus felt like I didn't understand the experience, and I didn't value the experience, and I didn't try to understand the experience. And one of the stories that I tell that I think helped me finally get it was, you know, my Princeton freshman weekend. Princeton does this thing where they group a bunch of people together to have a sort of outside of school experience. It's supposed to be a bonding experience, and they sold it by saying, you know, most people made friendships that lasted forever on this weekend. So I went on this weekend. I was the only black person there. I was the only Nigerian there. But for some reason, at 17, for the first time in my life, I was super conscious of the color of my skin. I didn't fit in. At least it seemed like I didn't fit in. Nobody seemed to care about my experience. People weren't asking me about, you know, where I grew up or all the other things. And so I started to wonder, like, am I not fitting in because I'm black? And then my intellectual self, because I had always grown up, you know, being a very intellectual person, and I hated the idea of, you know, race baiting. And thinking, I was like, why am I thinking about my race? Like, why is it not about the fact that I'm not Nigerian and I'm not American, and I don't understand the nursery school rhymes, you know, all the stuff that they are talking about that didn't make sense to me. But for some reason, I was so conscious of and it made me so uncomfortable, because it wasn't something that I was used to, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop it, right? I'm like, stop thinking. It's not about, what about this and all the other things? But that was always there. And nobody else, again, like, nobody ever acknowledges it, right? But I felt it. And that, you know, over the years, as I thought about that experience, I thought about what it's like for somebody who is black in America, who has that experience, whether consciously or not. Yeah. You know, maybe subconsciously, because they don't really have something to compare it to, right? Because they, you know, that's what they've known. But what it would feel like to have this experience of not belonging and not having someplace else to claim belonging, like I did with Nigeria.
Yeah.
Right? Because this is home, right? This is what you know. There's no place else. And yet, you don't feel like you belong here because you've been portrayed as an outcast or as, like, the bad, the fringe, right? Here, right? So I think that really kind of helped to crystallize for me, you know, why sort of, you know, really acknowledging racial identity, being in solidarity with, you know, why it was important. So.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about your story, I'm Amaka, and we talk about this often, but sometimes, you know, when people come to this country, right, and they have the experience that you have, you know, they don't choose to be in solidarity with the oppressed group here, right? And you said that it took you a while to see that, but you realize that in many ways, you know, you were coming into a racialized story, right? That the story of America is a racialized story, and you couldn't be indifferent about that, right? You were assigned a race upon arrival, essentially, right? And to be a responsible person, right, it seems like you needed to do the right thing with that. So why do you think America is so racialized, right? Like, what's up with that?
She's like, big question. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about this, right? And I have some thoughts, but you studied this. So I'm going to throw it right back to you. Why is it so racial? You tell me.
Wow. So it's a great question, you know. I think you know, one of the reasons that I love what you confirm with the story of your life, Amaka, is that it does match up with the literature and the research, right? part of the thing that makes us distinct and part of why I think it's so important for us to have these conversations on a Sunday morning is that America's origins are racial. The project is a racialized project. From this year, we're celebrating 400 years of the English of enslaved people coming to the English colonies, right? The wealth, the democracy building, all of that is a racialized story. Laws were crafted in Virginia that then were shared all across the colonies, right, to assign value depending on your race. They policed the movement of people because of their race. And so I think there's a way that we haven't gotten off that tight grip of that racialized story. But what's sinister, Amaka, is that we tell a different story as though to see race is to sort of make something up. So it's a type of national gaslighting, yeah. Right? It's a type of narrative gaslighting, right? That no, it's not a racialized story here. But then you read what the founding fathers said about race and what American citizenship was for. And that puts this week into context, because some of the founding fathers thought that American citizenship was only for white men. And so for those struggling with this question to belong, right, it's hard trying to find your place. And so, and I love how you said that, like, upon arrival, you noticed that there was this elephant in the room. Right, that here's this major racial elephant in the room, and yet Americans don't really acknowledge it. Why do you think it's important for us to acknowledge that elephant in the room? What's at stake for us?
So I think what you just said sort of crystallizes for me what I've experienced here, right? Which is that the history, because this is a question I asked for a long time. This is mostly during my college career. Like, why is it so racial, right? And why is it that not everybody acknowledges that it's so racial? It is, right? I think that it's because of the history, right? And the fact that we all carry that history with us. Whether you're white or you're black, you're carrying the history of the origin of this country, and you're either like actively acknowledging it or you're not, but that's why it's the elephant in the room, because it was there from the beginning. You know, and I think that it makes it more, it's more of an elephant in the room because, you know, the majority culture, you know, sometimes we try to pretend that this isn't the story. We're like trying to run away from the origin story, but then it shapes our experiences with each other. Mm. And that's why we have to acknowledge it, right?
Can you say more about how it shapes our experiences with each other?
I mean, you know, the way I describe, I think it's, you know, a black person carries that history of oppression with them, right? With your ancestors and the stories and, you know, the things that you've learned, the history, the things that sometimes make you angry, yeah. Right? And if you're, you know, I don't know how, there are other ways, even if you're not black, you still carry that history, yeah. Right, with you. And so it impacts your relationship with the other person, because you're either having certain expectations or you're waiting for something, right? For me, right, personally, I also found that the story of being black in America was a microcosm of the story of being African in the world, right? So what I came to understand was that the Black American story was already my story, even when I was in Nigeria. I just didn't know it, right? Because the Africa is the mismanaged, the dark continent. You know, it's also the bad box, right, in the world, not just in America, right? And so it's a part of why, again, I've processed it to come to understand why it's really important to acknowledge it and call it out and try to complicate it.
One of the things that you know that we try to push in this congregation, you know, today is August 11th, 2019, and we acknowledge it was my 5 year, which was August 10th, 2014, and the day before I started here was Saturday, August 9th, 2014, and as I was unpacking my apartment, I found out on Twitter that Michael Brown had been killed. And I saw his body on my Twitter feed as I was unpacking my apartment to get ready to be here sort of the next morning. And that's really shaped my consciousness. And I've tried for it to shape the consciousness of this congregation. And so I think we're striving to be anti-racist. And I worry if I'm pushing too much sometimes, right? And I worry if folks are going to be exhausted with this emphasis. But yet you helped me understand something. You said that for you, that's liberating for you.
Yeah, I mean, so what I said was that knowing that there are other people who understand, who get it, is liberating, right? Because it's exhausting to carry this burden of, like, you have to prove that you're not this bad thing, right? Like, the stereotype. And so I tell the story. I told you this is what, when we had this conversation, I told you that I remember when I started coming here and when you started preaching about, I don't know what you call it, like liberation theology, whatever. And I remember thinking sometimes thinking like, you know, is he going to do this again? How's everybody else feel about this? Is he going to be, you know, are they thinking like, here we go with this, like, you know, angry black man stuff. And I remember, and the reason why, you know, when I said what's liberating is knowing that the burden of explaining, of saying, no, it's not that, right? Here's why. Is not only on you that other people get it. That's liberating. And one of the, you know, we had a couple conversation. I can't remember what it was called. Post-sermon talk back or whatever. And I remember several people in this room, like, making comments. We were having I can't remember what it was you preached about that Sunday, but then I remember sitting down thinking, like, wow, people get it. That's cool. Like, I didn't say anything the whole time. Like, it wasn't like, you know, oh, that person has to explain why we do. No, like, I didn't say anything. And everybody else, I was learning from the other people in this church who have, you know, confronted, you know, who understand or who have shown that they're confronting issues of justice and oppression, you know, whatever. And I thought, wow, that is cool, right? So, like, I can just be, I don't have this burden anymore of trying to explain. Like, I can just be myself.
That's really powerful. And so quite tangibly, like, it makes your actual life better, right? Because it helps you to be able to live your life more freely. And so just another question for you then, and y'all hang tight. When you think about your identity, right, and you now claiming you're black in America, you're in solidarity with the black American struggle, you have two kids. You have a girl and a boy. You have Quesadilla and Sully, right? What do you think about their identities? How are you trying to sort of shape their life? How do they fit into this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot because my kids are American. They're not going to be able to claim Nigeria or Ghana. My husband is Ghana. I mean, that's a part of the identity, but they can't claim it in the way that I did, right? Because, like, this is, they need to know that they belong. Like, that is such an important part of being human, right? Of living, is that you have to belong somewhere. And so for me, I know that I have to raise them to actively know that they belong in America, right? As black girls and boys, that they're good and they belong. And that's not something that I can, like, allow to happen, right? Because it's, you know, you deny, they will experience life as black people in America. And if I don't you know, give them the tools or like let them know, then I'm denying the experience. Like if I let them just think that it doesn't matter, that they're just people, then I'll deny the experience.
It might harm them.
And that might mean exactly, it might be harder for them to be successful. So like I think about how I have to actively, you know, give them the tools to, you know, see injustice, whatever, call it out, realize that there might be instances where, you know, they feel like they don't belong, but that you belong. Though it doesn't matter what anybody says, this is your home.
You know, when you put it in that perspective, Amaka, when you talk about your kids and their complex identities, I don't just think about Selly and Quesaday, right? But I think about all of our kids and the complex identities that they have. You know, whether both of their parents are of the same race, whether their parents have different races, whether their parents have different immigration statuses, whether they have a different immigration status from their parents, right? I think our kids are carrying complex identities. And when you raise this question of belonging, right, I think you hit the nail on the head for what we're trying to do as a community, right? We're trying to make space for people to belong because so much of the experience outside is of not belonging, is of being excluded. You testify to that. I testify to that. In fact, most of us probably testify to that. But then the question of how do you get people to belong, right, is that you got to make space to see them, right? You got to be intentional about seeing them and about naming the stuff on them that's sort of lying to them about their identity. That's sort of telling them that, no, just be more normal, then you'll belong. Be less black, then you'll belong. Be less girly, then you'll belong. Be less queer, then you'll belong. Be less whatever, and then you'll belong. And at some point, right, the church has to say no to that. Like, let people be free, right? And let them have the space to be free and set up the space to be free so that they can belong. Am I honest? Am I interpreting your story correctly? Because it's peace about belonging. Do you have more to say about that? Or
no, I mean, the only thing I would say is exactly that, which is, you know, I think that people, you can, like, show that you get it, right? That's the way, if you were thinking about how can we all make sure that other people, that everybody around feels like they belong, just showing that you get it, right? And that means you intervene when there are, you know, awkward, just like you should if somebody says something dumb at work. Don't just be quiet and wait for them to deal with it on their own. Like, intervene. Like, you know, that's not appropriate. Whatever, right? And talk about it. Tell the different stories of the people, right? Nobody has a single story. Like, you know, tell the different stories. And that's how we can help everybody feel like they belong.
Lastly, you know, just to wrap it up, you said that, you know, your story of faith, right, starts with the real frustration with the Christianity of your upbringing, right? You felt like it was coercive, oppressive, and you're looking for something else, right? And so what does all of this mean for your faith now, right? Do you find an alternative? You know, I think you also mentioned to me that like, and I have to tell y'all this story. You know, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I was really perplexed, right, when you came in and you're like, I want to dedicate my kids here, right? And I was like, well, you know, normally like someone's like a member here for a while, you know, and we like get to know them, you know, you make sure you like us, you know, I was like, I'm going to understand, you know, what's this like? How do you know that we're the right place to raise your kids with you, right? To affirm their identity. And I think what you mirrored back to me in our conversation preparing for this is that the belonging piece and actively working for spaces to belong is part of why you go to church here, right? And so tell me a little bit more about that and what it all means for your faith right now.
Yeah. So for me, I think, you know, being a Christian, coming to church is about obviously becoming, trying to become a better person, right? But also being able to be my full self. And the experience that I had growing up was not that. And this was the first, I mean, and, you know, the truth is I haven't tried that many churches here, but, you know, I felt this at here at Calvary, where I didn't have to be afraid that, like, if I didn't believe this one part of the Bible, that I'm bad, right? Or, like, this story that doesn't make sense to me, then, you know, there was so much more liberty, right, to have different stories of the Bible, which to me is what I think faith should be about, right? It should be about allowing people to be their true selves. And that's one of the reasons why I had grown up in church and, you know, rejected it and, you know, felt that it was oppressive and everything. But I wanted my kids to have that foundation. And that's why, you know, I only really started coming to church after I had kids, you know, at least, you know, here in America. But yeah, that's why I started coming here.
Well, I really appreciate you, you know, being vulnerable with us and telling us about, you know, the path that you walked and are still walking. And I think, you know, we hold it with care. And I think we share the story because I believe and we believe that we can learn. We should learn. We must learn how to have the tools, how to equip one another to build communities where people can belong. And your story helps us to see that better, right? And you name where you messed up, right? Like, there's some folks at Princeton that you might have to mend some relationships still, right? But that conversion is possible, right? And I think that's just sort of the invitation this morning, right? That not to be congratulatory for Calvary, but to help you all know and see and to name for myself, you know, and Amaka, thank you for being a conversation partner, that I desperately want this to be a community where everyone belongs. But what that means is that we begin by asking questions about people who feel the most outside. And your investment in that includes those conversations. And even though it doesn't feel like faith, I think it's faith because I think it's the work of belonging. I think we get back to this text, you know, that's the fundamental problem with how we view this story of Hagar and Ishmael. Where do they belong? Where do they fit in? What is this God, if God isn't a God who cares for Hagar and Ishmael too, and how are we a reflection of that God if we don't do the same thing? So my invitation this morning, Calvary, is to keep addressing the elephant in the room. Don't be afraid of it. And keep working to make spaces where everyone belongs. And if you need to visualize it in the faces of our children who some are U.S. citizens and their parents are not, and that they go home and speak Spanish, and in school they're told to speak English, and they're trying to balance this black and white world too. Visualize it through them. And then, right, I know I'm talking a lot, but I'm taking the liberty. And then it might make sense why we read a portion of the gospel in Spanish every other week. Or I'll go on and on and on every week about what's happening in the world with racial issues because, like Amaka said, our kids really are already beginning to doubt their dignity and self-worth because of what's reflected back to them. So pastorally and congregationally, we have an obligation to them to say, no, your skin is beautiful. No, you are good. To hell with what the world says back to you. You are good, exactly as you are. Congregationally, we have that obligation to make space, not just to say it, but then for them to feel it. Okay, I'm done. Thank you, Amaka.